So welcome to this next lecture on virtual machines. So we wondered what happens when backtracking occurs, and we kind of compared backtracking conceptually with raising and throwing an exception. And so then this means we return to the backtrack point. This is a dynamically earlier stack frame where an alternative is open, and then recover the, so we return to the, once again I repeat what we have said there. So we set the frame pointer to that, to the frame of the backtrack point, and in the end we continue with the negative continuation address, which has been stored in that backtrack point. No, in the, yes, in the backtrack point. So in the backtrack point, we have recorded the code which has to be executed alternatively when the current version has failed. And in between, we have to do some resetting to get rid of all the effects the computation has triggered, or since the backtrack point has been left. And that means we remove everything which has been stored inside the heap since then, and we also reset the variables which have been set. And you now see these variables, if they, these variables have been created as objects in the new heap, since so has been allocated as new references inside the heap since since the backtrack point was established, then they will, these variables will be automatically removed simply due to popping the heap. But there are some variables which have existed earlier. So they are, their addresses are less than HP old. Less or equal to HP old. And these could have been set to new bindings. And these new bindings then must be undone. So that means for trailing and resetting of variables that we only trail those variables which have been created since the last backtrack. Which have been created before the last backtrack point. And bindings of these old variables then are must be reset explicitly and therefore are recorded on the trail. So therefore, accordingly, so let us see what therefore the, how the reset function then, the trail function is implemented. The trail function is implemented as follows. So you call it for the address of a variable. Then you check, you here check whether it is an old variable. That is, whether it is less or equal to the HP old, and and if you see HP old of the, please note that here it is not the frame pointer which we refer to, but the backtrack pointer, the pointer which keeps which holds the last the reference with the last backtrack point. And if something is older than that, in that stack frame we search for the HP old, and then reset everything, and then trail everything, every variable which has pre-existed at that time. And so if we have such, so once again, if we have such an old variable, we kind of put it onto the trail. And now for the resetting, so the resetting is called with two kind of references in the ref x. So x and y are addresses in the trail. And if and then we go down from y, this is the assume this is the larger one, to x, which is the smaller one, so that means for every reference which has been recorded there, we reset it to itself. Yeah, so it's a reference, and so the pointer in there we set to itself. So now, we know what happens at the back, when backtracking occurs. We know the organization of a backtrack point, and now we can kind of wrap it up in that sense by creating the code for a predicate. And once again, what should the code for a predicate do? A predicate corresponds to a procedure with multiple implementations. Each implementation is represented by a clause. And now, since Prolog is non-deterministic, it tries one of these implementations after the other. First the first clause, then the second clause, then the third clause. And so the code for the predicate or procedure has to add extra, organizational frame, so that after the first alternative, the next alternative is tried if the first one fails. Things like that, yeah? So that is now, so assume, very concretely, assume that our predicate is defined by clauses R1 to RF, and F is greater than 1. Then the first thing what we have to do is, so the code for the predicate, the code for the predicate consists of the code for the clauses plus some extra. What does the extra overhead do? First, it has to set the backtrack point. So whenever you call a predicate first, you have to set the backtrack point. Then you have to try the alternatives. And before the last alternative, you have to mark that now this frame is no longer a backtrack point, because as soon as you enter the last alternative, you will never return to that particular frame. So you have to delete the backtrack point. And in code, this is I suggest to have code in the following form. The code for a predicate consists of the code for the alternatives for the different clauses, where the start addresses, say, are A1 to AF. And then the code for the predicate here consists of the following. First, we set the backtrack point, whatever that means. We create a instruction for it. Then we have something. We try the first alternative, whatever that means. Yeah, so this is a new instruction. Then we try the last alternative, not the very last, but the second but last alternative. Then we delete the backtrack point, and then afterwards we jump to the last alternative, and it is a jump, because we definitely will never return to the code for the predicate P. Yeah. So now you see we have a lot of placeholders introduced here. We have the setting of the backtrack point introduced. We have the try, and we have the delete. So these three instructions we have to provide. Okay. So, but before we provide the implementation of these instructions, let us see how the code looks like. And as you see here, this is a very simple code. So we need the code so it's very easy to memorize. We have this, you could kind of call it, this is a try chain. And we also have an intuition what happens in the try chain. You first try, if you try an alternative, if everything goes well, you just follow that alternative and everything, and then compute to the very end. Only the next alternative is tried if something goes wrong. So you return into the try chain whenever a backtracking was triggered. So you have the try chain, including this deleting, yeah, and it starts with the setting. It then before the last alternative, you have the deleting of the backtrack point, you have to jump to the last one, and you have that block corresponding to the alternative. So that's very clear form of code, and therefore it is easy to create code for that schema. So here, consider that a little trivial definition of a predicate. So S has two alternatives. So we set the backtrack point. We try the first alternatives, assuming that the first alternative starts at A. And then already we have come to this. If that fails, we know that we can delete the backtrack point. We can delete the backtrack point because the next alternative is the last alternative, and after the last alternative, we will not return to this predicate because then all possibilities for that predicate have been exhausted. Yeah. So therefore, then comes the jump to the second alternative, to the second alternative, which I assume to start at B. Yeah. So that is the two alternatives. The code for the two alternatives starts. The code for the two alternatives starts at A, so this is this one, or at B, and that is this one. So the starting at A should be the first alternative. So you have one variable there, so therefore push env 1. You have one call, a T of X, so you mark a stack frame, and C is the positive continuation address. You mark the stack frame, you put the argument, so it's just a variable, and it's a second occurrence of the variables, therefore put ref 1, and then you call the predicate. And afterwards you kind of push the pop the environment, if possible. Okay, and for B, the second alternative, this is a unification. So again, there's only one variable, so therefore push env 1, and then we kind of have to generate the code for x equals a. Yesterday we saw how we do it. We put the left-hand side. The left-hand side is just put ref 1 because x is the second occurrence of x. The left-hand side is the second occurrence of a variable. Then we unify with the atom a, and then we are already done, and we pop the environment. Okay? So that is, in that sense, very simple, the code. And we are still left with the setting of the backtrack point, the trying, and the deleting. So here's the setting. So what should setting do? Well, setting is we set the backtrack point when we have a stack frame for a predicate, for a call to a predicate, say, Q. And then we have to, so it's a first occurrence, and it is a backtrack point because there are several alternatives, otherwise we wouldn't set the backtrack point. And we have to kind of initialize all the entries there, that all the organizational cells. So that means, in particular, we have to, the HP, the TP, and the BP are all, these three registers simply have to be stored in the organizational cells. Yeah? And what additionally do we have to do? That's all. In fact, that's all what we do. So still we have to do, we have to save the negative continuation address, which has not yet been initialized. That's the only thing which, the only register which still, or the only value which still has to be saved. And we have these two values, the PC and the FP old. But these have been set by the calling of the calling of the procedure. of the predicate. Yeah, so that is only, so these two entries are already initialized. So therefore, it is these three entries which we initialize, and that one we have to take care of, and we take care still to take care of, and we take care of by the try. So the try A will initialize the negative continuation address. And the question is, what is the negative continuation address if the current alternative A fails? And the answer is, it is just the current BC. Why? We have this try chain. So after the first try, we have the next try. And then, according to our virtual machine execution loop, the PC is incremented before we execute an instruction, and the incremented PC points to the next try, or to the last, if we are... So it's just the next instruction in the try chain, and that's precisely the value which we have to save here as negative continuation address. Yeah? So therefore, this try A is very nice, as it can set the current PC into the negative, into that place here, as negative continuation address. And here's interesting, so there's still a fourth set, so a fourth, which means so negative continuation address. So this is an error here. Okay? Any question? That's the trying, and now comes the deleting of a backtrack point. Now again, what does deleting mean? Well, it simply means that our backtrack pointer should no longer point to this frame here, but to the earlier backtrack pointer. Now, where do I get it from? Well, here it is stored here. So we take it and restore the backtrack pointer, and that's all. And by that, since then our register, the backtrack pointer has kind of gone deeper, now points deeper down into the stack. We will never jump back to that particular backtrack point. So deleting the backtrack point was very simple, and now you have seen all the three instructions which I have provided to you were very simple, and altogether they provide an implementation of this quite intricate frame of backtracking. So now, so you see, we make rapid progress in the implementation of Prolog. So still we have one thing which I have indicated to you, but not yet explained. And this is this popping of the environment. So, and the point is, we, as soon as we regularly reached the end of a clause, then that thinking, once again, thinking or considering a clause as an implementation of a procedure, we would like to pop. So we have successively executed the procedure we would like to pop. But we cannot pop if there's a backtrack point inside, because then we would kind of pop the backtrack point. And if there were a backtrack point inside, so inside the code, so when we executed one of these goals, we might have installed a backtrack point, because and then the frames for the backtrack point might still sit on the stack. And so, making a small picture, so for this R, that was a procedure, say a predicate, say Q, and then on top of it, in order, we kind of installed another frame here, say Q1. And this Q1 is a backtrack point. So we have that, then we cannot pop it, because there is another alternative which we might try. And then we might have, assuming that there's only a Q1. And then we have reached the end of the right-hand side of Q, and we would like to pop, and we cannot pop, because there's a backtrack point on top of it, which means there's a stack frame on top of the Q. And that means we have to keep it. So, but still the Q was called from some other predicate. Now I make it in green in order to... So there was another stack frame, let us call it P, which called Q. And that means that after implementation of Q, we return to this stack, to the green stack frame, and compute with the local variables introduced for the for this predicate P. Now I wonder. Yes. And we continue with the literals, executing the literals of the predicate P, of the current clause of the predicate P, and we can, and the stack has kind of accumulated various stack frames. And please note that now you may wonder if I take another alternative for the P, then I would have to another alternative means another clause for the P, and if I take another clause for the P, I have another set of locals. How can I do that? How can I install the locals for that other clause? And the answer is, if another clause for P is tried, then only if we backtrack back to P, and we backtrack back to P if all the backtrack points inside Q1 and inside Q have already been exhausted. So this means whenever we try another alternative for P, the stack has been popped up to that, up to P, or can be safely popped up to P, then we can try another alternative. So, but now, how can we detect? Is it difficult to detect when we can pop the stack, or how difficult? Yeah. So, is it easy or is it not? Is it difficult? And the answer is. Here is the sufficient criteria under which we can pop the stack frame. This is when we are in the last clause, or we have an only clause, and all goals in the body are definitely finished. Yeah, if we are not a last clause, then the current frame, the current procedure is a backtrack point, and then we cannot pop it. Or if not all goals in the body are finished, then there is a backtrack pointer, a backtrack point on top of the stack, which we do not want to pop. So on both criteria can be checked if by comparing the frame pointer with the backtrack pointer. If the frame pointer is larger than the backtrack pointer, then this means that that no backtrack pointer is on top of the frame, on top of the current stack frame, and the current stack frame cannot be a backtrack point, and therefore, in this case, we can pop the stack. So that is the condition we will check. So here it is. So the instruction: what does now popenv do? So popenv does two things. The first thing, it has to restore, and this it has to do under all circumstances. It has to restore the old frame pointer and the old PC, because we have to return to our caller. And that is, so this we do under all circumstances, and so that is happens here. And besides that, we try to pop. And trying to pop means we compare the frame pointer with the backtrack pointer, and if this is the case, then we set the stack pointer to frame pointer minus 6. This means we pop the stack. Yeah. Okay. And here is, so here in this case, it displayed to you a situation where in this picture where the stack cannot be popped, and that means and the reason is that the backtrack pointer here, I have indicated it points somewhere on top of the current frame pointer, and then we can set the frame pointer to the old frame pointer. This happens here. We set it to the old frame pointer, and we put the old PC into the PC and just continue. So by that, the stack is not shrinking, but we return to the earlier stack frame. Okay, so that kind of finishes the case for the popenv, and that means we are essentially done. The only thing what remains to do is to consider full programs, and full programs consist of a sequence of predicate definitions followed by some query, and the query could be simply just a single literal. Now what would we do? So if the query is raw, it does not hold, then there is we kind of have to indicate it, that is print no onto the screen, and that is done by some instruction no. And then there is we need code for the literal G and code for the predicate definitions. Essentially that is it. And before the query evaluation, we have to initialize the registers and allocate space for the globals, which is what are global variables. Well, these are variables in the initial query. For those, these variables must reside somewhere, and we provide space for that. And then after the query evaluation, we have to return the values of these globals. So typically, if the globals are X and Y, then Prolog comes up with X equals the binding for X and Y equals a binding for X, for Y. So that is the output of a Prolog program on the screen if you run it in interactive mode. Clearly, a standalone Prolog program will the starting query G typically is just has no arguments at all, and all the effects of the Prolog program will be due to side effects, to built-ins which kind of provide writing to files or things like that. But here we, in our little example world, we don't have such built-ins, but we may return values through the screen. And here, then, there is something more which we can do. We can hit the return key, and by that, telling the Prolog interpreter that we would like to see more solutions. And then, this means like backtracking will be triggered, and another solution will be provided, or no, if no other solution is available. Okay, so here is how we would do that. We initialize somehow the program, and my implementation, this init receives an address, which is the address of the instruction no. And then we have to, so this initializes some registers, and then we have to provide the space for the locals, or for the globals, for the variables in the query, and that is this pushenv thing. D is the number of free variables. Then we have this the code for the query. Then down there we have the code for the predicates. And following the code for the query, we have an instruction halt. And halt receives D, elements, it has the following effect. It should kind of terminate program execution and return the bindings of the D globals. And since Halt does not know in itself how many globals are there, I have created this D, I have provided this extra argument D, so that the Halt instruction can extract the bindings for the globals from the stack and the heap. Okay, so it returns the bindings. And now it also then it takes input, as I said, it takes input return. And if that happens, it causes backtracking. And that would mean simply it evaluates the as if there is false. If you hit return, what will do? What will happen? Then the runtime routine backtrack will be called. It is as if a unification has failed afterwards, and that means the execution will return to the last backtrack point and try another alternative, and by that provide hopefully another implementation and another value for the globals. Okay, so here is what init does. So init sets does very little. So initially the stack is empty, and we have some initial values in our registers. So in particular, frame pointer, all the stack pointers like frame T, P, and BP, all these pointers have no legal value so far, so they receive the value -1 in beginning, and the heap pointer is maybe 0. And then we initialize initializing means that we initialize the stack frame with a meaningful the first stack frame with meaningful values, and that means in particular, so here in these places which are BP old, TP old, and HP old, we kind of have this the values from the current registers. And the only interesting point is here, for the negative continuation address, we choose A. And that means if everything fails, the next alternative will jump to the instruction where we return no, and then program execution terminates. Okay, so now with that, so that was the last instruction required. So here, let's see what we have. So we have a little program. The query is P. P has no arguments. P is implemented with a single clause using predicates Q and T. Q is also single. And T is single, and S has two. We have seen the code for S already. Is a non-deterministic predicate having two clauses. Okay, so it's very small, and the reason why it is very small is so that the code fits into one slide, as always. So because otherwise, if it were a meaningful program, then it would be large, and then we would see nothing. Okay, so here is the code. We start with this init thing. Then we put we translate the query P. So now P has no argument, no variables. So therefore, we make a push env 0, and then we mark a stack frame for the call. We call P because there's no arguments to be provided, and then we halt. And so halt 0 because there is no variable bound by a success by any call, by any evaluation of that program. And so the N here in the init, this is exactly the N here, which corresponds to the code, to the address of the instruction node. Okay, so, and now we kind of have to, now come the routine matters. So the first, the implementation of the predicate T. So here is the implementation of the predicate T. Now T is a single, is implemented by a single clause. So therefore the code for T is the code for the clause for T. And the code for the clause, the code for the clause for T of T. So we push, make push env one because there's only one variable. And then the code for the, for x equals b. For this unification, and that means we put the put ref 1 puts x, then we u atom b unifies with b, and then we pop the environment. That's it. Yeah? Okay, so let us see, go for the next one. P, the predicate P is equally simple. So it is this piece of code. P is again a single, implemented by a single by a single clause, so therefore it is the code for the clause. So one variable only, so therefore I put env, push env 1. Then here is the code for the first literal. It has variable x and calls q. And here is the code for the second literal. It again calls x, puts x and then calls now, but now calls t. And then we pop the environment. Okay, and for Q, it is even, it's now, you see, it's a little bit repetitive. For Q, the thing looks the same. It is a single, Q is implemented by a single clause. So therefore, the code for Q is the code for the clause. And then we kind of put, so one variable, therefore push env 1. In the end, a pop env. And then here in between, we have the query s of t, which is implemented in that way, marking a stack frame, putting a reference to x, and then calling s. Okay, and the code for s, now perhaps you are exhausted, and I am also exhausted. This code for s is more complicated, because we have to do the try chain first, but we have seen the code for S already a few slides earlier. So therefore, I only recall for you that this is the try chain, and here come the codes for the two clauses, and the try chains kind of sews together the code for the alternatives. Is there any question? So that is kind of in this sense we could say okay, now we are done with Prolog and everything is easy and we go home. But the point is a little bit even more than for the implementation of functional languages, this code is horribly inefficient. And so in functional languages, we immediately came up with some kind of natural optimizations for some of the inefficiencies. We kind of optimized the closures, and we optimized the last calls. And I may recall to you, this last call optimization was crucial in order to have something like a constant space loop, constant space iteration. And now... this is important because otherwise these declarative languages tend to consume huge amounts of money, and space, and memory. I wanted to say memory. The last call optimization allowed us to have to be tremendously more space efficient. And the same question now arises whether we could do similar things here for Prolog. And in fact, it must be said that the original Prolog interpreters, which were tremendously slow and tremendously inefficient, and you could only do tiny toy examples. And then came a kind of breakthrough, and that was the Warren abstract machine. And the Warren abstract machine did not come as a plain virtual machine like the ones which we have shown, I have shown you, but it came with a huge number of all kinds of optimizations. So therefore, the description of the Warren abstract machine is a book, and it was the PhD thesis of Warren. I don't know what Warren is doing today. I should look it up and put a photo of him into the slides, perhaps. And it is a book. And what we do here is kind of this version, which I have shown you here, is a simplified version, without any optimization. And so now we do some of the optimizations of the Warren abstract machine, actually the most important ones. And he has then some extra optimizations by introducing registers. So that pass. So here we have no registers. Everything is done on the stack. He has introduced registers and done a lot of calculations on registers. And so this kind of nibbling around with registers, one could do it. Actually, this is at some point I considered that as a meaningful subject for some kind of master thesis or so, that one takes all these virtual machines and rephrases them with registers and doing all the optimizations for the registers. So let us see what kind of optimizations we could do. So the first thing is, and the most important one, actually there are two very important optimizations which we will discuss, and the first one is this last call optimization in order to do something like this tail recursive something in functional programming. What is the gist of these optimizations? The gist is when we have a call to, in this case, to a predicate, we would like to reuse the current stack frame for another call where we otherwise would have created a new stack frame. But clearly, we can use this new, we can reuse our current stack frame only if there is no backtrack point in the current, between the current stack frame and the one which we now want to install. So only in this situation, and we should not return to the current stack frame. So it's really so we are done with our current stack frame so that it can be reused for the next call. So that is philosophically what is the conditions under which we can deal with it. So let us consider here the append function, the append predicate. So we have two clauses. So here's the first clause, here's the second clause. Now consider what is the last... So there is only one recursive call, and this is this one. And it is the last call in the last clause. So definitely, when this clause is entered, there is the current predicate up cannot be a backtrack point. Yeah, because it's the last one. So we have given up the backtrack point. And also, before it, to the left of it, there is nothing. There is only unification code. So no backtrack point is installed. So this means really, this one, for this call, we can reuse the stack frame of that call. Yeah? So that is the idea. So here we should be, this predicate should be implementable without increasing the stack. Which turns it into kind of an iteration. But another thing is, so the question whether something is a last call or not. So here I have kind of shown you that this up is globally the last call. But we would like to define the notion of a last call only with respect to a particular clause. And whether it is the globally, the currently, the whether there is no spectra point or not, this we would kind of keep leave to a dynamic check. So so consider here we have one individual clause, and now a last call then is this GN. If GN is a literal, if GN were a unification code, then it is not a call, and then the GN minus one is also no last call, because something you have to return to the stack frame in order to do this final unification. Okay, so in this case, assume that this whole clause has m locals, m at least greater or equal to k, and the last the GN is a literal with which calls the predicate Q, and then the normal code for that clause would look as follows. We push M, we make push N for M. We provide the code for all the left for G1 to GN minus 1. And then comes the code for the last literal. And then afterwards we pop the environment. So I mark it in red. Okay? So that would be the normal one. And now what we would like to do is, instead of giving up of popping the environment here, we would like to kind of essentially pop it here, or put it. Would try to put it to pop it here, or equivalently, would like to, instead of marking a new stack frame, we would like to reuse the current stack frame. So, in order to do so, we replace this mark B by a new instruction which I call last mark, and the final two instructions, the call to the queue and followed by the pop env, is combined to a new instruction which I call last call. And this last call requires as arguments, well, the predicate which is called, and also the number of locals which the original stack frame has. Because the new call might have 20 locals, while the original one had 50. Then you have to rescale the 50 to 20. So that means you have to set the stack and you have to kind of pop things off. Mark instruction, mark always initializes the stack frame. Okay, so let's see what. So that is now code which we would generate. Here we have the last mark, and here we have the last call. So let's see what the last mark should do. So as I said, so locally inside this clause, we might have the we might identify the last whether a literal is the last one, but then we have to know, we have to realize whether it really is the last literal inside the evaluation of the current predicate. So therefore, we have to check whether there is no backtrack point on the stack coming from G1 to GN minus 1. Whether no such backtrack point exists, And also whether the if it is not last, then the frame pointer is less or equal to the backtrack point. Yeah, if it's equal to the backtrack point, then okay, so then we cannot give up the stack frame because we might return to it because there is another alternative to try. So, and if some G1 to GN minus 1 created backtrack points, then we have even a backtrack point above FP. So therefore, we have to check this FP less or equal to BP. And if that is the case, then we are not lucky. And then the last mark... behaves as if it were an ordinary marking, yeah. As if it were an ordinary marking where it puts. So let me see. Yeah. So if the frame pointer is less than, so in this situation, and the only thing is what is the positive continuation address. This is the only optimization which we can do, so that we copy the, and therefore this last mark needs no. So other usually mark receives an extra argument which provides the positive continuation address. In that case of the last literal of the last call, we don't need. We don't need this extra argument because we can copy this positive continuation address from our caller to the callee because we do not, at least if there is no backtracking, we will not return to the current stack frame. Okay, so that's the only thing which we can do. And otherwise, also the frame pointer is saved. So therefore, this is put onto this into the current stack frame. And so we have saved nothing. Now, but that was only half of the story. If this the condition is not true, then, and that's the point, we do simply nothing. So we do not do any saving. We do nothing simply. Yeah. And that's the optimization. Okay. Now, let's go to the second instruction which we introduced. This is his last call. Again, if the frame pointer is less or equal to BP, then last call has to behave in the same way as the call. And in particular, this popenv, there is no popenv because popenv would not be possible because we cannot pop the environment. Yeah, so therefore it behaves like the call. Otherwise, that was the situation where the marking did not kind of where the marking did nothing. The last call must do something, and the last call. So again, here if. This was the case where we could do no optimization. And otherwise, what would we do? Well, then we have created the arguments of the last call on top of the stack. And below, we have the M locals of the caller. The M locals of the caller are no longer needed. They have to be squeezed out. And the H new arguments have to kind of be moved down. And this is done by this moving the H values M instructions down the stack. And afterwards, so by that we have replaced the original locals with the actual parameters, and then we jump to the predicate of the last call. Yeah. So here is what the moving does. It kind of where was it? Yeah. This move down. Yeah. So these H things are moved M instructions down. M down. And afterwards this Q, H, the label is kind of put into the PC. Okay. So now let's see how that kind of how the code looks like. So code generation, so the one thing is clearly is so the code generation schemes are often very simple here in this prologue, but the definition of the instructions which we introduce, this is always a little bit intricate. So here is one clause. So here is that is obviously a last call. And so therefore the code for this clause, how does it look like? First we count variables x, y, and x1. So therefore we have a push and 3. And then we have the code for the first literal. So this is here. And then we have the code for the last literal, and accordingly, so this is here. And as we have decided upon, it starts with the last mark, and it ends with the last call. And the last call here receives this 3 as an argument, because there are 3 locals in the clause altogether. Okay. Now, if we know that the clause is always a last clause, so this is in the lucky case that we know more, that we know the context in which a clause is called. In this case, and we know that the last literal is the only one, then we know that the backtrack pointer cannot be the same as the frame pointer. This is due to, because it's not, it is the last one. And there can be no backtrack point be on top of it, because there is here in this case to the left of the last, to the left of the last call. Here in this case it is not the case. Here is a literal, and this could introduce backtrack points, but in the case of the append function, so that was, it was definitely the last clause, and in this position there was only a unification which would not create backtrack points. So in that case this last mark, which did this runtime check whether we have whether it is safe to reuse the stack frame, this can be simply dropped. There is nothing there, and this last calling does not require a runtime check anymore, but can directly be replaced by these two instructions. Yeah. So accordingly, if we use this optimization, we could translate this last clause of the append as follows. So here is the code for the So this is altogether we have 6 variables, so therefore a push env 6. Then we have to do the code for unification of all the unification codes come down here. It starts, and all that is unification code, and it goes until this point. All this green stuff is unification code, and then comes the code for the last literal, and the, since it's the last, the last mark has been, it would have been, here would be the last mark, which I have kind of cancelled, and then comes this code, which produces the creates the arguments for the call, and that is x prime, y, and z prime, and all of them have occurred earlier. So therefore, I put ref all these three variables are created by means of put ref instructions, and it is 5, 2, and 6 as relative addresses, because x prime is the fifth, and x y is the second, and z prime is the sixth variable. Okay, and once we have, we are done with creating the arguments for the recursive call, we do, we move them up, and you see we do no no checking, because we are sure it is there is no backtrack point in place, and then instead of call going doing a last call, we do a jump. And you see here within this all this clause there is no calling at all, it's only jumping. So this is a true loop. So is there a question? So then this is now, I am not so sure how important that optimization is. So the idea is interesting, but yeah, see, the idea is interesting, and one might try, one might consider it. Whether it is a very important in optimization, I'm not so completely sure. But what one could do is one could try to shrink stack space by squeezing out variables out of the stack whenever possible. So that is the idea. And so that would one would do. And I guess we did a little bit. I don't know whether Stefan made a, a corresponding optimization you could also do for functional languages. And even you could think of it for, if you have Java, you could think of as soon, so in functional languages, you could think of, you have these global vectors, and the global vectors hold references to values of variables used in an expression. But as soon as you are sure that you have seen the last use of a variable, you could kind of nullify it in the global vector. What kind of, why should one do it? It's like in Java. When as soon as you have a reference, you have at some place you had a last reference to an object, you might override this reference with null. Why should you do it? Yes, by that you try to decrease the number of references as much as possible, and by doing so you kind of help the garbage collector. Here one could, well, here we kind of squeeze them out of the stack by kind of by that decrease the stack space. But another advantage of that kind of optimization is that we kind of remove certain references to heap objects and help the garbage collector. So here's an example where one could try to do something. So here's a very long clause, and you see here, so there's a variable x, so let us make it in red. X is introduced here. Well, it's a, one must say, actual parameters cannot be easily squeezed out. Why? Hmm? So there is no return value for, there is no return value. Hmm?
We still need the
know. There is no return value. Prolog has no return values. So it's all by side effects. So in fact, we only need the axis and the value of X and Z if there's backtracking. And we return to this particular call if this is not the last clause. Yeah? Because then we would have to call another clause for A, and then we need the same X and the same Z. So we cannot nullify X and Z, because then we could not kind of do the backtracking. But if we know that backtracking will not return to that because the backtrack pointer is further below, then I can also override the X and the Z. Yeah? So that's kind of the point. So the Z has a very long, so it is the last use is over there. But here there are the true local variables which are not affected by backtracking. So this is this X1 here, and that is the last use of X1 is here. And the X2 is introduced here, and the last use is here. So for the next literal, it is not needed. And the X3, okay, so it's introduced here and used there. Now what we could do, so what we see is that after that literal P2, the variable X1 is dead. And after the literal P3, X2 is dead. So therefore we could arrange the variables according to lifetimes. So that is those with the longer lifetime we put first, and those with the shorter lifetime we put later into the stack. And that means when we kind of are done with the literal for the variable X5, we could kind of decrease the stack pointer by one. And that is done by the trim operation. After every non-last goal with dead variables, we insert this instruction trim, or we may insert it, and that checks whether there's whether the frame pointer is greater or equal to BP, and if so, it sets it to it decrements the. If the frame pointer is equal to the BP or greater than the BP, then we can do this trimming. And once again, we could even trim. Arguments if the frame pointer were greater than the backtrack pointer. So here is So this trimming again introduces runtime checks, and you may say, this makes it expensive. But this is true, but the Prolog programmers have so much problems with memory that they happily insert runtime checks to gain space. So they trade checks for space. So here is, and the observation is that they do that other, and later we will see there are techniques to remove the number of backtrack, to reduce the number of backtrack points. And the fewer backtrack points are around, the more efficient the trimming and last call optimization and all that stuff will be. Okay, so now here is the code for this clause in presence of this trimming. And to enable the trimming, we have arranged the variables here according to lifetimes, and I have kept out X and Z from the optimization because they are parameters. So now this is one clause, and we have five variables in it. So therefore, push N5. And then we have the code for the first literal. It is this one. So it looks as usual with marking, putting, and calling. Then we have the code for the second literal. This is here, for the third one is here, and for the last one, I perhaps mark it in blue, this is this one. Please observe that at that point here, I have only a last call 3, because as soon as I arrive at that position, there is no backtrack point has been left on the, there cannot be. So this moving down, if it takes place, it can only take place if no backtrack point has been left on the stack, and that means that the trimming, both trimming operations could have taken place earlier. And that means that we are sure that then there are only 3 local variables left. Yeah, because otherwise, yeah, you see, if one of the trim operations could not succeed, then if one of them did not succeed, then the last call could not, then this would be wrong. But it is, since, yeah, if one of the trim operations would not have succeeded, then also the last call will not be able to do the optimization. Yeah, and this trimming here is to 4, I mark it in red, is to 4. Why? Because after the first literal, which is here, I can, after the second literal, that is the first place where we can do an optimization, the x1 is no longer required, so therefore the highest relative address is 4, and therefore we can do trim 4. And here also x2 goes out of scope, and that means we can only require so up to x3, and that means up to relative address 3, and therefore trim 3. Okay, is there a question? So that was the first optimization, this trimming, it's debatable how useful that is, but now comes something which is extremely useful, and no Prolog implementation can do without that. And that, I would say, the Warren Abstract Machine, you get a decent Prolog implementation already with our things. Forget about the registers, but use the last call optimization and clause indexing. And then you can do most of the stuff, gain most of the efficiency. So what is the idea of clause indexing, or what is the deficiency which we try to attack? So currently it is like that. A predicate is implemented by a sequence of clauses. We try one after the other, which is stupid, because we see that in the query, the literal starts with argument A, and so all the clauses which start with something, do unification with B or something, they can never be called. So we could look, search, or kind of filter the clauses for those which where the first argument starts with has A. Yeah, so that's the idea. And so the idea is, what we would like to do is we inspect the first argument and try to, depending on that, try to exclude alternatives which we can statically identify as not unifying. And so by that, we kind of avoid the search space for matching alternatives is reduced. And in many cases, it's even so that there is no choice at all. Think of the append function. So the first argument makes this case distinction between the empty list and the non-empty list. And there's no choice, because there's one clause for the empty list and one for the non-empty list. It's completely deterministic. Completely deterministic means there is no backtrack point. So no backtracking at all. And that's great, because then it's really a loop, what we have. Yeah. So backtracking refers to shorter lists of alternatives. And that means that we are more often determined. So backtrack points are earlier removed, and that means that stack frames are earlier popped. So the case distinction gets faster, but also the stack consumption gets tremendously reduced. So this clause this was a very ingenious invention. Well, perhaps not so ingenious, but a very useful thing to do to get a decent Prolog implementation. Okay, so here is our super duper example. So the append function. So now everything depends on if I have somewhere a query up, and then somebody writes X, and then what is it? 1 and 2. No, 1, 2, 1, something like that. So now we are doomed. Yeah. So if I have a query like that, then I don't know which clause to apply. Yeah. So this is kind of, if we invert the concatenation operation, which means we want to take that apart so that the second argument is 1. And clearly this is not so easy. And that is in which we have to do backtracking. But this is not kind of the regular way how we apply the append predicate. So the regular way of applying the append predicate is if we have a query, and the query tells us, please append this list and that list, and we want to know this, where their concatenation. And then we look at the first argument, we see it's a constructor application, and it is this clause which matches, and that does not match because it's with the empty list. Yeah? And therefore it is no choice at all. We have to take the second. We don't create a backtrack point. We go for the second clause, we evaluate the second clause, and then we are done. Yeah? Okay. So what we do is, so we kind of look what kind of constructors we find in unification code for the first argument. So here our clauses typically start with unification equalities for the first argument. And then these kind of, the right-hand sides we inspect, these are trees, constructor trees. And we collect the root constructor there. Yeah. So then the idea is, for any such root constructor, we introduce a separate try chain. So when we see there is a unification with A, B, C, and D, then we have a try chain for where the first argument is A, a try chain where the first argument is B, and one for the C. And then in the implementation, we will kind of inspect the root node, and depending on the root node for the of the first argument, and then depending what we see there, we use one of the try chains. If the root node if the first argument is a variable, then we are doomed. We cannot kind of filter out a dedicated. So then we have to kind of for that case we provide a default try chain where all the clauses are tried. Yeah, and now depending on so inspecting the root node of the first argument of the call to the predicate, we find either a constructor or a variable, and then we use this value to kind of make an indexed jump to the corresponding try chain. Yeah, okay. So so that I spare you a kind of an algorithm writing down how the try chains are produced, but I will kind of give you quickly an example how that is done. Assume that these T chains are the sequence of try chains for the root constructors obtained by unifications x1 equals t. And then the code looks as follows. So here we see how that t, what did I call it? These t chains are how these look like. So here, so here we consider again the up predicate, and here are the tri-chains which I would like to introduce. So okay, so for the first, if for the var case, when the inspection of the root of this right-hand side of x1, if this is a variable, then we have to do both alternatives. That is, we have to set the backtrack point, we have to try the first alternative, we have to delete the backtrack point and jump to the second alternative. So this is as we would have done it before. Now, in case that we find the first argument is unified with the atom, no, that the first argument is of the query is the empty list, so it's nil, and then we have to check what kind of what is the subsequence of clauses where x1, where we find the unification x1 equals nil, and then we see there is just one, so therefore we can immediately jump to that alternative. And in the case of the, if the root node is a constructor, then again there's only one alternative where we find that on the right-hand side of x1 in a unification goal, we find only one alternative with a constructor, and that is and this is the alternative a2. And otherwise, if something, if we call append for any other constructor. Okay, so we have no clause for which may match. So therefore, there is a fail, and fail is a particular goal which we introduce, which immediately calls backtrack. Yeah. So that's it, and then we would kind of the code for a predicate now looks as follows. We kind of we access the first argument. This is put ref 1. We retrieve the root node of that of the binding. This is this get node thing, and then we use that value to index into our tri chains. And then following that, we have, as usual, the code for the various alternatives. But please please remark that the same clause may occur in multiple tri-chains. So here is that we try the alternative starting at A1, and here we do the same. And in this occurrence... In this occurrence, the same clause is a last clause, where here it is not a last clause, because there's still another alternative to try. Yeah? And that is the reason that we cannot statically, just looking at the clause, determine whether it is a last clause or not. So that even if it is syntactically not a last clause, it may be so that by filtering, that in some try chains, it may occur as a last clause, while in other tri-chains it may not occur as a last clause. Yeah, so therefore these one-time checks somehow, which we introduced, were not kind of so... we had to do that. Okay, so then here is... now what kind of new instructions did we introduce? So this getting the node and indexing. These are things which we have not yet considered what it looks like. So getting the node is very simple. So we have a reference to some constructed term in the heap, and we just check for the value of it. So we get the f, or if it's an unbound variable, perhaps put the R. So one special symbol telling us that it's a variable. Okay, so this is the getting of nodes. Then the indexing is, now we have this predicate P. So this tells us, so we are searching for the right trichain of the predicate P. And now we have the second, on top of the stack, we have the name of a constructor, the name of an atom, or R. And then we use this value to kind of determine the right trichain. How do we determine it? I don't know. So therefore, I have this mapping here. And in practice, recall that when we try to implement the switch statement, we kind of carefully designed a jump table and made an index jump into that to find the alternative. So here for Prolog, one is a little bit more careless or more liberal in saying that the runtime system simply provides a hash table. And it just takes the name of the predicate or some kind of index. If you have kind of the front end has provided you with an identifier, a number or so, representing P, K, and then you simply use these two things to look up in a hash table. And that's typically fast enough. So by that, using such kind of a hash table data structure, you can access the start label of the corresponding trichain quickly enough. And that value is returned by this map thing. And this is put into the PC because that means that we jump there and then follow the dry chain, which is written there. Okay. Yeah. And so that's this. And now we have a decent Prolog implementation. Do you have any question? If not, then comes the next step in direction of a practical implementation, and that is the cut. Actually, so we have, when I said we have a decent Prolog implementation, then that is true, but it's not completely true because we kind of non-determinist. So what we do is we have no possibility to restrict the search space. So there's no pruning of search spaces, and in practical Prolog programming, this virtually always results in non-termination. Either you have very small problems. So as soon as something is recursive, you might, or you might want to traverse a graph or something, you will probably typically fail. So what one really needs, what practical Prolog programming requires, is this cut operator. Who of you has done a little bit of Prolog programming? None? So you never heard of the cut operator? Now what is the cut operator? The cut operator says, and the next time, next week, we will kind of discuss that in greater detail. Okay, so once I have proven that, found an X which verifies, which makes P of X true, then comes the cut, and I freeze. I do not back. Even if that here fails, I will not return and try to reprove this one. That's the idea of the cut. For example, if you want to implement an if-then-else by means. So here is, this is something like an if-then-else. So if the condition is true, then I want to choose this branch. And that means I want to continue with the yellow thing. And if the yellow thing fails, I do not want to reprove the condition. I want to do something. I want to go to the I want to do something completely else. So, So I also do not. If this fails, I do not kind of continue with that one. I make it in black. So this is also forbidden because it simply means that if the then part, then the whole predicate fails, then the whole branch fails. Yeah. So this does this. So the cut operator does not only freeze that I do not reprove that I do not reprove this one, but also means that whenever that fails, then the branch fails. So this means I give up the backtrack point of branch also. Yeah, so I set the backtrack point, if you like, to the predecessor of branch by doing the cut. Okay? And so it's a little bit of a weird thing, and operationally, I must say, the cut operator is a practical necessity, but makes the control flow of Prolog programs extremely difficult. So all this denotational thinking, I define predicates and they mean something, is kind of obfuscated and counter. It's no longer true once you have this cut. But for today, I would say we are done, and we meet again next week. And thank you for your attention.